Hello and welcome to a very experimental version of the Jazz Podcast. I'm sitting outside in Richmond with Henry Lowther. So this could go one of two ways for us, because we haven't done an outdoor show before. We've done a cafe, and this has a similar level of ambient noise. So you can listen in, as we will, on the conversation of the people next to us, or you can listen to Henry. Up to you.
Is it in the 60s, I remember, the Maharishi yogi would never give interviews on the grounds that as a Hindu monk, he was forbidden to talk about himself. Well, I'm not a Hindu monk, but I understand where he's coming from, Raju.
A relief to us all.
Yeah.
So, where did you grow up?
In Leicester.
Cool. How long did you live there for?
Apart from 1 year I spent at music college, I lived there for the first, 22 years of my life.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you went to college, you studied violin?
I did, yes.
So did you did violin first?
Well, I started in brass bands when I was a boy, Salvation Army.
Right.
And I didn't actually join a band for quite a long time, but my father taught me. And then eventually I was persuaded by a boy who I was friendly with to join the band that he played in what's known as Leicester Central Corps, and I had to kind of do an audition. Well, the truth was, of course, by that stage I could already play really well.
Yeah.
So I sort of just, they couldn't believe me, in fact.
Great.
So that's when I started playing in actual band.
Right.
But I changed the violin throughout my teenage years.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a really unusual mix, because I guess you don't get that much in common.
Yeah. Well, it is an unusual mix, although it wouldn't have been so unusual in the old theatres about, 100 odd years ago, when Dublin was very common among theatre musicians, although probably they didn't play to a particularly high standard. But there's unusual things like saxophone and violin and this one, trumpet, violin. And of course, in the history of jazz, there was always Ray Nance, in the Ellington band, he played trumpet and violin. And also, there's a very good, I forget his name now, in this country, he plays trumpet and violin. Well, what's his name? Anyway. So there are people that have done it. Well, Ornette Coleman.
Really?
But he played violin, trumpet and alto, didn't he?
Cool.
Although one can't say he was all that competent on trumpet or violin.
So what made you... Do you remember what inspired you to play the trumpet?
Well, I mean, apart from when I was a boy and playing in brass bands, I came back to playing the trumpet, really. It's a long story, this, but I was introduced to Indian music during the year that I spent at the Royal Academy. I was introduced to Indian classical music.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was an element of improvisation and things, and it fascinated me. And I was aware of jazz. My brother-in-law, for example, used to like the Jerry Mulligan Quartet, the original one with Chet Baker.
Yeah.
And also things like Ella Fitzgerald, a lot of popular jazz, Oscar Peterson, the Modern Jazz Quartet, Dave Brubeck. I was aware of that, and I remember seeing a mainstream band at one point in my life with Buck Clayton. But I never considered playing jazz, but when I heard Indian music, it gave me another idea. But the first thing that really turned me on was Sonny Rollins.
Yeah.
I heard Sonny Rollins on the radio playing this long improvisation, and it had just bass and drums, and there was a kind of dialogue between the saxophone and the drums.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of Indian music, and even the bass is not exactly playing a drone, but it's like a background to, in the way that works in Indian classical music. And I suddenly thought, well, that's a Western technique that maybe I can maybe I can do something like that. Yeah. You know? So that was my first real inspiration. And then I discovered a lot of other jazz. And as a trumpet player, I suppose the first two people that had a big influence on me was Miles Davis and Clifford Brown.
Yeah.
They played a big role in my life, and often detected their influence.
Yeah.
One can never shake off our influences.
No, of course. So who are you playing with then in London?
Well, I started playing in Leicester, in fact, with some, right. with some guys that played in a kind of mainstream band in Leicester University, students, who played in a kind of Johnny Hodges jump-style band.
Yeah.
I wanted to play more modern music at that point in my life, and I played with them. Then I met some local musicians, and then one of those students moved to London. I had a day job. We used to do all sorts of things in a day job. My main job was turning a lathe. But I,
what's that?
A lathe.
Yeah.
It's a machine that goes round.
Right.
And you can cut and shape round things with it.
Oh, okay.
You know, like for example, table legs or something.
Yeah.
Made of wood. Although mine was an engineering factory, and I used to do things in turn things in metal. You know, using blueprints, which were in use in those days.
Yeah.
Things like that. I was quite skilled after a couple of years doing that. But this student, I was playing jazz in my spare time and things with some local musicians. And I did want to play with, you know, really a higher standard of musician.
Yeah.
And this student, when he got a job teaching at Barking Technical College, nothing to do with music, but he wrote to me and said he'd got a place in a flat in London if I wanted to go, and I suddenly thought I should go to London. So that was in 1963, about March time. I know it was the really bad winter that was, and it snowed snow and ice for about 3 months
right.
that year. I remember being on the train going to London, and there was snow everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I moved in with him for a short while and played with him and some other people. I don't know who they were now. Actually, in Barking Technical College, you know.
Cool.
Then I met some people in London, notably the great saxophone player who never really became very well known. He was called Lynn Dobson.
Right.
And through, you know, you slowly expand the people you know. There was a violinist I'd been at college with. He had the same professor as me. It was a guy called John Francis. He's still around, and he plays jazz on the violin. He's playing cafe orchestras and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he used to play a bit of alto when I first met him. And he introduced me to one or two places where I could sit in. I met people like Coleridge Good and Derek Warner, who was a piano player, who used to be played with the Ted Heath band, and he was also assistant MD for years with the Top of the Pops Orchestra.
Yeah.
I remember playing with him in the pub, and also there's a club in Soho called the Sphinx. I used to go down there, and I met some guys there I played with, you know, and it was slowly it kind of went from there, really.
Yeah.
And I suppose I have to tell the sort of my experience with Tubby Hayes in my early years in London.
Yeah,
you know.
That'd be great.
But, when I was still living in Leicester, Tubby Hayes advertised for musicians to join a student rehearsal band, a big band.
Yeah.
I wrote off for it, but I never got a reply. But when I came back to London, this violinist, John Francis, had stopped playing the violin at this point in his life and started playing the dual bass. And he was having lessons with Freddie Logan, who was Tubby Hayes' bass player
right.
at that time. And he told me one day, he said, Tubby's got his rehearsal band on Sunday afternoon in Ronnie Scott's. That was the old Ronnie Scott's when it used to be in Gerrard Street.
Yeah.
He said, why don't you just come down and have a listen? So I went down. Tubby wasn't there. But the guy that used to play lead trumpet in the band was a guy called Dennis Darlow.
Right.
And he'd had a big band, which I remember seeing in Leicester. a small big band with Tony Levin on drums,
mm-hmm.
I remember. However, because Tubby wasn't there, this guy Dennis Darlow took the rehearsal,
yeah.
which meant that there were now a trumpet short, and I happened to be there with a trumpet. So I sat on the end on fourth trumpet.
Nice, cool.
And then Tubby came down. But the other guys in his quintet at the time were there, like Alan Ganley, Terry Shannon, and Freddie Logan.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Duca, great trumpet player, Jimmy Duca. And Tubby came down at the end of the rehearsal, and then that evening, Jimmy Duca flew off to America in the evening with Ronnie Scott and Ronnie Ross. So Tubby was playing in the club that night with a quartet, and I just hung around. And I have to say, in the afternoon, I never played anything in this big band. Like, I didn't play any solo trumpet or any lead trumpet, anything like that.
Yeah.
I just played parts,
yeah.
the fourth trumpet. And then in the evening, when I stayed around the club and heard Tubby Hayes play, as he went on stage for the second set, he tapped me on the shoulder as he walked by and he said, "Fancy a blow?" And I couldn't believe it. I'd only been in London 2 months.
Yeah.
And here was the great Tubby Hayes.
Mm.
You know, and this was the great, famous Ronnie Scott's club.
Yeah.
And he invited me up on the stage. Now, I was terrified.
Yeah.
As you can expect.
Yeah.
However, it was one of those moments in your life when you go, if I turn this down, I'm only going to kick myself afterwards. So.
Yeah.
So I just went on stage terrified, and I played the whole set with him. There's only three tunes.
Yeah.
Because he used to play long length, you know. And I do remember what we played. We played Straight No Chaser, Yesterday's, and then he asked me what I wanted to play, and I said, Once in a While. He said, no, let's play something stompy. Do you know what is this thing called love? I said, yes, I do. But he roared into that as a tempo that I'd never even played at half that speed before. And I just waggled the valves,
yeah.
you know, what we sometimes call oranges. It's like it's getting an orange and rolling it across the top of the valves. And then it was an effect like that.
Yeah, right? Brilliant.
But it was an amazing. However, I thought I'd got it made then. I thought, that's it.
Yeah.
However, the real world doesn't really work like that.
Yeah.
So I didn't have it made. And
so what were you doing for, like, were you earning money out of playing, or did you have another job still?
No, I had various jobs to support myself. But of course, I did earn some money, just odd gigs, and it was a weird experience. Really. For quite a while, I had a job with the Automobile Association.
Yeah,
and I worked in Holloway Road, and then they moved me to Feynham House, which was in Leicester Square. It was the Automobile Association's headquarters. But I was going out in the evenings, and I used to earn something like £14 a week. In the day job,
mm-hmm.
in the evening I might earn £3, £4, £5 for a couple of gigs, which made me, in a funny kind of way, it made me think I was, you know, I was better off than the colleagues I was working with in the day
yeah.
job, because
yeah.
they weren't earning £3, £4, or £5
yeah.
pounds. So, you know, if I just 2 gigs a week, you know, and I used to play in Ronnie Scott's old place after Ronnie Scott's club had vacated it and moved to Frith Street. The lease still had a couple of years to run, so it became a very famous place for new jazz, younger jazz, experimental
wow.
music. It became a very important place. In fact,
did it have a name?
It was just called the Old Place.
Right.
It was Ronnie's Old Place.
Right.
Yeah, I used to play down there, and eventually, in my day job, I got a call from a guy that used to book musicians with John Dankworth, you know. I started playing with John Dankworth at that time.
Yeah.
And of course, I played with John Dankworth's bands over all the years until he died, you know. And
yeah.
In fact, the longest serving John Dankworth musician.
Wow.
In fact.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What an accolade.
Yeah.
John signed one of my saxophones.
Did he?
When I was like 18.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he came to my school and we did a big band gig with him. And
oh, yeah.
Had a permanent marker afterwards, and I was like, this is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, I thought he would add thousands, like,
oh,
to
wow,
the resale
yeah.
value.
Curiously enough, of course, he was the first he was the first professor of jazz at the Royal Academy.
Really?
And he wasn't used to teaching, but he asked me to go in with him once.
Yeah.
And join him in a class.
Yeah.
As he put it, so you could tell them how you do it or what you do.
Yeah.
And I did do that, and he bought me lunch in Alpino's in Marylebone High Street. I've forgotten though, before that, of course, I did do a period where I joined a famous pop group for 9 months, so it was Manfred Mann.
Right.
I did that for 9 months, and of course I made a lot more money than I could ever earn in a day's work when I was doing that, you know. And it wasn't great money, but it was certainly more than I was earning in a day job.
Do you remember how you got into those pop? Because your pop CV is really quite big.
Are they?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Well, like you've played with Elton John.
Oh yeah, that was all years later.
Yeah,
they're the sort of thing that I don't even remember because that was what happens when you're. What happens when you're a studio musician?
Right.
You just go into the studio like you're going to an office.
Right.
Sort of thing,
did you even know what it was, or did you just play the
sometimes,
tracks?
But not always.
Right.
I knew that was Elton John when I did that, although he wasn't there.
Right.
He was just
Stan
producing.
Saltzman told me that he played with Herbie Hancock.
Yes, he
but
did.
He didn't know that Herbie was there.
Yeah.
Until he looked round his screen.
Yeah.
You know, and saw the guy.
Yeah, that's right. That sort of thing can happen.
Yeah.
You know? So years later, you find discographers. You say, "Oh, I didn't know I did that." But the pop group came about with me because I used to play with this legendary. From time to time, I knew and used to play with this legendary musician in the sort of that period about 64, 65, called Mike Taylor.
Right.
Who became a legend, and then I don't know what you call that. Like a mental problem, like schizophrenia or something, you know.
Right.
And probably, I don't know whether it was possibly caused by using LSD or something.
Yeah.
But he was a very eccentric musician, but quite amazingly original talent.
Yeah.
He used to play with John Heisen on drums, and bass player Tony Reeves, and a saxophone player called Dave Tomlin. And then I got a call one day from Dave Tomlin saying, there's a famous pop group, want a trumpet player, would you be interested in doing it? And I said, no, not really, I just want to play jazz. And I have to say, I had no ambitions to be a professional musician at that point in my life. I never actually thought I was good enough to be a professional. And so I turned it down. And then a couple of days later, I was walking through sort of near Leicester Square, and I saw an advert for the Melody Maker, and it said Manfred wants more men. So then I knew that it was Manfred Mann. Well, that band had a reputation for being into jazz.
Right.
Manfred Mann used to write a column in a jazz newspaper in those days,
right,
on how to play jazz piano or something like that. And I suddenly thought, well, that can't be bad. That's not quite. So I thought, I'll go for it. So I phoned this guy Dave Tomlin up and said, is it still, have they got anybody yet? He said, no. He said, they're having auditions tomorrow morning in the Notre Dame Hall at Leicester Square. So I said, OK, I'll be there. And I went along, but it was already my gig before I got there.
Yeah.
They said, they weren't auditioning anybody else on the strength of Dave Tomlin's reputation, and possibly they might have heard of me, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I did join that band, and then Dave Tomlin pulled out, and I wrote my friend Lynn Dobson in. And and I always have to tell an amusing story here. Paul Jones used to be the singer in the band. He's repeated this on air a couple of times, so it's now common knowledge.
Yeah.
But Lynn Dobson kind of fell out with the band, really, and he used to hitchhike to gigs with his girlfriend. And there wasn't room for them to travel in the transport. We used separate cars, their cars, you know. And so we had a gig in Bridlington, not the easiest place to hitchhike to from London.
Yeah.
You know, on the east coast of Yorkshire. And he turned up, you know, about 15 minutes before we due to play. We only used to do 45 minutes, that's all they ever did in that band, you know. And he turned up and suddenly he comes over to me. He said, oh, I don't know what to do. He said, I've got no reeds. I've left my reeds in London. So I said, he said, well, look, don't tell anybody. and he got a bit of paper and folded it up and stuck it in the mouthpiece so it kind of looked like a reed. And of course, he just went on stage, didn't play a note, just mimed. And nobody noticed.
Wow.
It used to be so loud.
Yeah.
And in those days, you want not the way they do things today. There's no monitoring, because monitoring had not been invented, because you stick a microphone in front of the speaker, it howls. But they've not invented a system which prevents that. And these days, of course, when loud gigs, they shove it all out the front.
Yeah.
They're on stage, the guitarist probably using little amplifiers.
Yeah.
In those days, you stand in front of those giant, you know, Marshall stacks and all that.
Yeah.
And all that sound is behind you, you know, it's amazing we can hear it all.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and of course, nobody could tell that he wasn't playing, you know.
That's amazing.
That was a...
That's kind of wonderful and depressing all at once. that nobody notices either way, but at least you got away with it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So a listener actually wrote me a message today asking if I'd ask you what it was like working with Gil Evans.
Chaos. But it was, of course, it was wonderful. It was very, you know, very honoured and flattered that I had those experiences with Gil Evans.
Yeah.
Not only the two times he came over here with a British band, one was a tour we did, the other was two seasons at Ronnie Scott's. One was 2 weeks long, one was one week. He also, of course, he got roped into doing some film music at that time.
Yeah.
He wrote the arrangements for Absolute Beginners film.
Right.
He also he wrote an arrangement of the slow movement from the Mozart Jupiter Symphony, like a reorchestration.
Oh, wow.
Using woodwind, horns, two muted trumpets, two flugelhorns, and would you believe a conga drummer? The Mozart's. And if I remember the conga drummer, he didn't write him a part or anything.
Yeah.
It was a guy, Tony Carr, was a lovely bloke. He originally came from Malta. I always remember a puzzled look on his face, you know, and he's going, Gil, what do I do? And he used to, Gil would say, oh, just make it up, play anything you like.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't expect that somehow.
Well,
kind of go to all that effort to orchestrate it and then tell someone to just, you know.
Well, he did like
free
that.
Up over
he
the
did
top.
Like that, particularly later. I mean, the days of all the tight arrangements like Miles Ahead and Porgy and Bess.
Yeah.
That era was long behind Gil, you know, and he was like doing kind of like the fusion music like Miles was doing. And
yeah.
I mean, and a lot of it was just like the arranging part of it, the orchestration arranging wasn't an important part of what he was doing at that time. I mean, we did play Gone regularly.
Yeah.
You know, from Porgy and Bess.
Yeah.
Also an arrangement he did of Orange Is the Colour of... the colour was it orange was the colour of her dress and then blue silk,
right?
Charlie Mingus tune, and he did a rave, and that was about the only time really when anything was tightly arranged. But I mean, he was commissioned to write a piece to come to London,
yeah.
So we got in the rehearsal studio, Naomi's studio in Shepherd's Bush, and he handed these parts out, and he just had three notes on it, you know. It was a brass figure going duh, duh, duh. And it was a bass figure. It went on for a while and then went up a fourth. And the brass go duh, 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 on the, and it went up a fourth. And that was all he wrote. And it was called London. And this was his commission.
So how much he got paid to
I don't know, but he was notorious, of course, for not completing scores on time and stuff like that. You know, he was notorious for that. But he was such a sweet man, though. I mean, he really was a lovely guy. And I also went to Montreux with him to do... He was invited to play piano with this RMS band. That was Ray Russell, Mo Foster and Simon Phillips.
Yeah.
And we because of Gil Evans' name, we topped the bill. We topped the bill above VSOP. You know, the Marsalis brothers and the Herbie Hancock, Tony Williams and Ron Carter. But we topped the bill.
Brilliant.
Because of Gil Evans. But, and Gil just said, this is the first time in my life I've ever been booked as a piano player. And of course he was no great piano player, you know, but he was his name, but he was a great sitting in the garden of the hotel in Montreal, you know, having conversation with him about things. He was great.
Yeah.
He actually told me that he spent 6 months in Eastport to do with his eyes. And I've never read that anywhere. Nobody seems to know about it.
To do with what? His eyes?
He had terrible eyesight.
Right.
He had awful eyesight. Right. And it was... And he told me that, and it wasn't lost on me that he loved Debussy, and Debussy completed La Mer in the Grand Hotel in Eastport.
Wow.
You know, that wasn't lost on me.
Yeah.
Whether he went there, but of course he wouldn't have been able to afford to stay in the Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
He had no money, you know.
Right.
Because he never made any money, because he wasn't really a composer. So he didn't get composer's royalties. He was an arranger.
Right.
Arrangers don't get composer's royalties.
No.
But Miles used to give him money, I know, you know, when he was short of money.
Right.
Miles used to give him the money, you know.
Yeah.
I feel very, you know, lucky talking about all that, because I feel very inside a lot of that kind of thing, because I was lucky enough also to, you know, Dave Holland introduced me to Miles Davis.
Wow.
In 1969, you
That's
know.
That's amazing. Where did that happen?
In Shelley's Manhole.
Right.
In Hollywood. And Miles was charming, and he was more interested in me than I was in him, because I was playing in a rock band.
Right.
You know, in to 1,000 people every night.
Yeah.
Miles is playing to 50 people in a jazz club.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know whether I played solos, because playing trumpet in a rock band was relatively unusual in those days.
Right.
So he was interested in what I was doing in a rock band.
Yeah.
And he was quite through. Dave Holland and people, he was quite kind of interested in what was going on in London, you know.
Yeah.
Miles, and it was a really nice experience, you know. I went down two nights, and the second night he just walked by me and said, "Hi there." he was great, you know.
Wow.
And of course, at that period of his life, he had the band, didn't record very much, with Dave Holland and Jack DeJohnette, Chick Corea, Wayne Shorter. And Miles is still playing on the Changes and on the Time. But the minute he left the States, they used to go out into the outer space and play free improv music, you know.
Oh, wow.
And Miles would come back and say, bring it back into tempo and play the head again, you know. It was like, he was losing his audience because the music was long gone. It's 10 years since Kind of Blue and Sketches of Spain, his popular recordings, you know. 10 years had gone by since then, so he wasn't enjoying a lot. Dave Holland said to me recently, when he joined Miles, he couldn't believe how few people they were playing to in the clubs.
Right.
Just handfuls of people.
Yeah.
You can hear that if you listen to, like, the Plug Nickel, for example.
Yeah.
You can hear there's nobody there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird now. I kind of feel like how I feel about the moon landings. Like, if people would have known, it would have only been those few, there would have been more.
Yeah.
Now it seems like really painful to imagine,
only
50 people going to watch him.
Anyway, as I was saying, I've been playing, working with Gil Evans, and then in recent years I've played those Gil Evans, Miles Davis things as the soloist through Scott Stroman a few times now.
Right.
I played Miles Ahead a couple of times. And of course, I did it with Miles Evans, Gil's son, you know. Miles Evans was, he came over here when he was 18 with Gil.
Yeah.
When we did the tour.
Yeah.
You know, but Gil wouldn't let him play anything. He used to just say, just sit there and learn from these guys. And Miles was 18. And he was lessons with Miles Davis.
Right.
And he was Miles Davis's godson. And Miles paid for him to come over to England.
Wow.
Miles paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, for him to come.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a few years later, I did the Vortex, like two performances of Miles Ed, sharing the solo role with Miles Evans. And somehow, you know, I played Porgy and Bess twice. I played Sketches of Spain once with Guildhall students, so I feel very close to all that, you know, Miles and Gil Evans and amazing.
It's amazing to talk about, because for me that world feels really far away, and then to talk to you about it, and you've got, like, to have met him, you know, that's really something.
Of course, Dave Holland is the one to talk to about.
Yeah.
He spent 3 years with Miles, you know.
Yeah.
And he had the greatest regard for Miles in not only as a musician but as a person, you know.
Yeah.
I said Miles was an amazing guy.
Yeah.
And so Mont said to Dave, well, what about all the famously hostile and belligerent? And he said, well, he said he had a very keen sense of bullshit, of what was bullshit and what wasn't. So
yeah.
As long as he thought you were genuine, it was fine, you know.
Right.
But he was surrounded by bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
So but that's
So then, do you have like a favourite decade when you think back on what you've done so far with your career?
You mean me personally?
Yeah.
I think my favourite decade is now.
Right. That's a great answer.
These are the good old days.
Yeah. I try and say that to myself a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's easy always to be looking back at stuff, you know.
Yeah. Of course, you know, my age and been around, I've had enormous experience of all sorts of things in music.
Yeah.
I do have this sort of sense that I'm looking back over it
in
a way that I, say 20 years ago or something like that, I probably wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
I just look back over it and I think I've been lucky to be in the places where I've been, you know, at those times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I look upon it as all of it as a stroke of luck. I think I've been very lucky. And, you know, and I look back on it and think, wow. When I think, well, when I was at sort of school studying A-level music and going to my violin lessons and playing violin in the Leicester Symphony Orchestra or something, you know, I sort of, I never knew that it would come, or turn out the way that it turned out.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I never had any ambitions at my early life in London to be a professional musician.
Yeah.
I never thought that, I had the ability. And I also remember I played in this band in my early years with Lynn Dobson and the piano player Tony Hymas. You know of him at all? Well, I mean, he's an amazing musician, and I mean, he worked a lot of stuff with Jeff Beck over the years. He had a hit record with a band called PhD in the early 80s.
Right.
And also, he's written classical music, was an incredible piano player. He made a recording that he's given to me of Charles Ives' Concord Sonata.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he can play, this guy.
Yeah.
And because he was also, for a little while, he was John Dankworth Cleone's pianist.
Right.
You know, after John Taylor.
Yeah.
And John Taylor did that gig for a while.
Yeah.
And then Tony Imus did. And then Paul Hart.
Right.
And then John Haller. And anyway, he's an amazing musician, Tony Imus. He was the piano player when in that little quintet we had, you know. Harry Miller, bass player, who went to live in Holland and was killed in a car crash. He was kind of got a big name in all that scene with the South African musicians in London. Harry Miller and a mad drummer called... and I never really knew his real name because he changed his name. He was schizophrenic as well. He was we knew him as Lewis... I think his name was Lewis Owen.
Right.
We used to call him... Or was it Henry Owen? And he called himself Lewis. I'm not sure. But anyway, there was a competition at the old Richmond Jazz Festival just across the road here.
Oh, cool.
In the playing fields, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we entered this competition, played there, and we won. But I remember standing in this tent, backstage, as it were, and the Ted Heath Band were on later in the day.
Yeah.
And I heard this trumpet player warming up. And it was frightening. I kept thinking, Christ, is that how good you got to be to be a professional trumpet player?
Yeah.
I heard this guy. And years later, of course, I worked with that guy, and I'm recognising his warm-up. And he was Bert Ezard.
Right.
He used to play with the old Teddy band. And he was an amazing trumpet player. He kept in touch with Kenny Wheeler all over the years, you know.
Right,
After he retired to Whitby in Yorkshire. But Kenny told me he used to phone him. Like, you know, like every few months, chat. I think he's still alive, as far as I know. He lives in Whitby. But he was the trumpet player I heard warming up, and I remember frightening me to death. I knew his, years later, I knew his warm up, you know.
Yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
So, when do you remember meeting like Kenny Wheeler and John Taylor and kind of, because you're on the Music for Small and Large Ensemble album, held as the standard for large ensemble,
That's
writing.
Yeah. Sadly, of course, I'm the only trumpet player left from that album.
Really?
You know, they're all
Derek Watkins.
Yeah, he died. He died. Ian Hamer.
Yeah.
Alan Downey.
Wow, that's really
and,
sad.
And Kenny Wheeler and Kenny himself. Yeah. So I'm the only remaining trumpet player now.
Wow.
Which is a very weird place to be,
Yeah, of course.
Very sad and very weird for me. I wish those guys were all still around, you know.
Yeah.
I love them, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
I met Kenny in the mid 60s. I met him. I don't quite remember the first time meeting him, but I did work with him in. I worked with him a lot in studio work too, as well. A bit later, not then. But he, I remember playing with the New Jazz Orchestra in Notre Dame Hall, and Kenny Wheeler was there or something.
Yeah.
And I remember Ian Carr saying to me that Kenny Wheeler said to him, "Who's that trumpet player?" I played. They had an arrangement of Major Cadiz from the Miles Ahead album, and I played the solo on that. And I remember Ian Carr telling me that Kenny was there, and he said, "Blimey, who's that trumpet player?" But I remember I worked with him quite often at that time in a couple of situations, and then eventually, of course, the John Dankwith band, because there was two significant recordings at that time. There was John Dankwith's own The Million Dollar Collection, and then of course there was the legendary Windmill Tilter album. It was Kenny's first ever album under his own name.
Wow.
And a big band album. It was the John Dankwith Orchestra with all Kenny's writing.
Yeah.
You never heard that?
No.
Oh, it's I think it's available on CD now, but it was unavailable for years. It was like lost. No, you've got to hear that.
Yeah.
It's an incredible album.
Yeah.
I mean, the writing is just out of sight.
Yeah.
And but we played some of those pieces with the John Dankwith band before that album was recorded.
Yeah.
And then what? I think somebody, I think probably John Dankwith, persuaded Kenny to give it, like, make it into a concept album. So the original titles of those tunes were, you know, gave new titles to suit the sort of story of Don Quixote,
Who
you famously tilted at Windmills.
That's where
it came from. Oh, you must get that.
Yeah.
I think it's still available. If not, just get in touch with me and I'll do a copy of it.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Thanks. Yeah, love
it. It's incredible writing.
Yeah.
And John Dankwith at that time had his band had an unusual lineup. It wasn't a conventional big band.
Right.
It had a trumpet section, three players. And then he had two sections of mixed instruments. But Kenny used to be down the front in the section of mixed instruments. And the great names in that early band. I mean, one section was Kenny, Mike Gibbs on trombone, Tony Roberts, fantastic musician. He's still around living in Dorset. One of my favourite musicians, Tony Roberts. I'm not sure which alto player it was, either John Dankwith or the other one was Ray Swinfield. Then the other section, mixed instrument, was either John Dankwith or Ray Swinfield. And Chris Pine on trombone, Tony Coe, and a tuba player called Dick Hart. And the music was written for that different kind of lineup, you know.
Yeah.
And the Windmill Tilter was written for, or adapted, I think, some of those tunes had been written before.
Yeah.
It was adapted for that lineup.
Yeah.
Then a bit later, they recorded these interludes with a small quintet.
Right.
With of course, the bass player on that album is Dave Holland.
Yeah.
Who was only there because the Dankwith bass player, Kenny Napa, was ill.
Right.
And Dave Holland ended up doing it.
Yeah.
And the quintet, it was just Kenny and Tony Coe. The drummer was a guy called John Spooner, Dankwith's drummer, who, strangely enough, I went to school with.
Cool.
In the same class at school for 5 years, although we weren't particularly friends.
Right.
And he was into playing the drums at that time, and I was still into classical music,
as it were.
And But anyway, he was the drummer. But then the guitarist on those short, small tracks is John McLaughlin.
Right.
And it's possible that it was that album that Dave Holland played to Miles Davis.
Ah, cool.
And that's when John McLaughlin got the invitation.
Right. Oh, wow.
Yeah. That might be because of that album.
Yeah. I remember going to the Pizza Express like 6 years ago and seeing Kenny play like a quintet gig.
Yeah.
And they played Mark Time. And he said, yeah. I wrote this for when my son was born in 1957. I felt like I've been smacked around the face, this tune. It sounds like it was written in like the late 70s.
Yeah.
Like you say about the writing kind of being just way out there.
Well, Kenny studied, you know, with Richard Rodney Bennett.
I think
a lot of that stuff came out of there. And there's a couple of guys into that kind of new sort of harmony around them. They're like Bob Cornford and Pat Smythe.
Yeah.
Piano player used to play with Joe Harriott. And but Kenny studied with composition with Richard Rodney Bennett.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
You know, you knew a thing or two, Kenny. As we all know, you know.
Oh, amazing.
And of course, it was a great privilege for me, you know, it was also a personal friend of mine as well as a music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how's the like, it's a bit of an obvious question, really, because I kind of feel like I know how it's changed. But how do you feel like the session scene has changed in London over the years?
When you say sessions, you mean studio work?
Yeah, I suppose, and all the like the pop stuff you've done that you like you say you suppose wouldn't really know.
I mean, I'm not involved in it anymore. Yeah. And
is that because it doesn't exist, or just?
I don't think it's anything like as big as it used to be.
Right.
Just in the same way that, you know, like gramophone recording, that's an old-fashioned expression, but it's the one that's still used in the music industry.
You know,
and when the musicians' union negotiate session rights, they still call it the gramophone recording. But I mean, it doesn't exist in the same way it did before. It's harder to make that kind of money than it used to be. Not, I don't mean for us, I don't mean for musicians like me, I mean for pop artists, popular music artists themselves. I mean, I don't think they can make money like they used to be able to.
Yeah.
And certainly there's less of it. And of course, with technology, so many things can be reproduced. I mean, I've always had this theory. People used to laugh at it in the old days when I used to go into recording studios, and you might have a reception area in the studio, and they'd have these magazines lying around, and they're all about the music industry. They were never about music, you know, like Billboard and all sorts of things like that. And I used to pick them up and I used to say, oh, what's this got to do with us? Because none of it had anything to do with it. And I've always had this theory, and it's in a way it's finally come to be, that the music industry would just love to have got rid of musicians.
Yeah.
The musicians were a pain in the arse to the recording.
Unpredictable force. Yeah.
Well, also, they didn't want to spend the money on them, did they? You know. So, and in fact, it's come to that, really. I mean, when you think about it, you know, so much popular music you see on television, you never see musicians.
No.
They're not there.
No, they're kind of trying to be hidden.
They've disappeared, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, and a lot of the music itself is not even made by musicians.
Yeah.
It's made by people messing about on computers, you know. I know the creative people can do wonders with technology.
Yeah.
Not trying to diminish its use or something, but the things like it's amazing how the sort of control of a lot of it went into the hands of these people who knew nothing about music.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a wonderful example of this. Is when I got called to go to a studio in Great Marlborough Street. I've never been to that studio before or since. It was a lot larger than I expected, but it was used primarily for voiceovers on jingles.
Right.
And I walked in and these two young blokes in there, I'd been told, my brief before I went there, that they'd used a sampled saxophone and they decided they didn't like it and they wanted to try a Miles Davis style muted trumpet.
Yeah.
So I got booked to go in. So I went in and this guy come up to me and he said, I don't know anything about music. I mean, people can say things like that now without any shame, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't think about music, but this was the question. He said, can you play all of the notes on a trumpet? Now, to this day, I don't know what he meant. I mean, did he mean all 88 notes on a keyboard?
Yeah.
Or did he mean just just the bugle, five notes like on bugle calls, you know.
Yeah.
Or me personally, was I capable of playing all the notes on a trumpet? You know,
to
this day I don't know, you know what he meant. But that gives you an example of the music business, the hands of a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And when I've worked with, you know, I don't want to kind of mention too many names, you know, people who, at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, they knew nothing about music, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're sometimes popular artists that have become very famous, you know.
Yeah.
Or the record producers who knew nothing at all but became big names in record production.
Yeah.
And you wonder how that came about, really.
I'm voting for the
amazing,
a very, very bizarre industry that we have.
And it still goes on in a way. I mean, one of the interesting things of a musician's life is how you find yourself in unusual situations.
Yeah.
And Paul Clarvis is a very close friend of me, and we've done all sorts of odd things together. We have a thing now about a sort of, you can call it a repertoire, if you like, about all the strange gigs we found ourselves doing, all the strange, not only gigs, but strange situations.
Yeah.
And, you know, we often sometimes had to just look back, because as a musician, you do find yourself in weird situations doing weird things.
Yeah.
It's like,
is there anything that stands out for you? Talking about it now, of like, you know, really weird situations, really totally bizarre gigs or anything that you've been doing.
I can remember getting called to some, I don't know, it was like a tunnel or a, I don't know what it was, like a cellar underneath the railway arches or somewhere on the South Bank sometime, and it was a private party.
Yeah.
And some guy had phoned me up and I think what it was, he sort of wanted something like live music, but he wasn't booking a band, and I didn't know what, and I turned up, and it was somebody was going off on something like a motor rally in Brazil, and this was the farewell party.
Right.
And I turned up and I got there and they were, what am I supposed to do? And they wanted me to put records on.
Yeah.
They want me to play along to the records. I mean, and the you know, records I don't know. They're not the records, you know, like pop songs or something, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what I did in the end. I mean, probably just blew some rubbish over the top of these records, you know, and they decided themselves this wasn't quite what they had in mind, you know. So took my money and said, right, it was okay, you can go now. Took my money and left, you know. And I can think of things like that.
Yeah.
And I was not exactly a strange situation, but I mean, I am one of the few British musicians left that, well, there weren't that many in the first place. I played at Woodstock, of course, the famous historical festival in 1969, you know.
How was that?
Well, once we got there, it was I was very nervous, actually.
Yeah.
You know, the love and peace kind of image of Woodstock, which came out on the film and all that, didn't quite feel like that when you were there, because the organisers of the festival were terrified that it might all go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, they'd planned for about 30,000 people or something.
Yeah.
And there was like 500,000 there.
Yeah.
In one field with no food, no water, no adequate toilet facilities.
Oh, it sounds horrible.
It rained in the mud.
Yeah.
And it could quite easily. And the message from the stage was, it was a kind of, you know, at the time it was an attempted revolution in America, really.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like the hippie revolution. So let's show them that we're better than them.
Yeah.
And we love one another. I mean, that was the message from the stage.
Yeah.
And in a way, it worked. You know.
Yeah.
I remember John Sebastian, who did the compare and stoned out of his brain. And that was the message from the stage. And we were told, you know, don't drink from any already opened can or bottle.
Yeah.
Because the people going around spiking them all LSD, you know.
Yeah.
We're told not to.
Yeah.
And then there was a sort of thing, you know, like cigarettes or something, you know, people are so you got a cigarette, and you, and people will give you the whole packet.
Yeah.
And then they got those. So they haven't got any cigarettes now. So then you go. And so they'd go, have you got a cigarette? And they'd give you that packet. You know, this sort of a sharing sort of vibe, you know.
Yeah.
And but because we to fly in by helicopter and stuff like that, you know. It was an amazing experience just getting there because we got it was our first gig off the plane, and I'd never been to America before at that time. And our manager, called Johnny Jones, who picked us up at the airport, and he had a young girl with him from the office or something, the record company, you know, and the big car.
Yeah.
And we went up the Highway 17, and there was this almighty thunderstorm of a severity I've never witnessed in Britain.
Right.
And we were hungry, and you know, all the cars were pulling off the highway into the service areas, and they were packed, so we came off the road altogether and went into a small town or village, really. By which time the rain had stopped and the sun had come out, and we're sitting in there, they had the radio on, and the radio was on a 10-mile long traffic jam on Highway 17, all caused by this festival. And 10 minutes later, 10 miles became 20 miles.
Oh, no.
And then they're saying that, you know, they declared the festival site a disaster zone. And they were sending in the army. And they couldn't get, the army couldn't get there.
Yeah.
Because all the roads were blocked.
Yeah.
But people just abandoned their cars.
Yeah.
And so we think, well, how are we going to get there? We've got to get to a little town called Liberty where the hotel was booked.
Yeah.
So we bought a map.
Yeah.
And we navigated all these back roads through the Catskill Mountains. And there was all, we came across all these people dressed in all black with pigtails and big hats, beards, or walking along the road or on horses and carts. I thought they were Jews at first.
Yeah.
In fact, they were Amish people.
Right, yeah.
You know, and we went through these areas, and eventually we got to the Liberty, and it was... The booking system in the hotel had broken down, and people were sleeping in the corridors everything. So our manager nipped up the road and found a motel. They had two rooms left.
Yeah,
there was eight in our party, and we shared two rooms, eight of us. And we picked up our roadie at Liberty for the tour, and I remember seeing the Who were in the restaurant there.
Cool.
While we were there.
Nice.
And then we stayed the night. There was unbelievable thunderstorms in the night. The noise, it's incredible. And then next day went to an airfield and tried to get on a helicopter, but we couldn't get on a helicopter because doctors had priority, and there were five doctors in, and they were bringing out people mostly on bad acid trips.
Yeah.
But
what a mess.
Yeah, and then we had to try and get on a helicopter to leave.
Yeah.
Before nightfall, because the helicopters weren't flying, you know.
Yeah.
And then we managed it. And the next day we went into New York, and we were back on Highway 70. There's all these cars parked for miles.
Yeah.
A lot of people who didn't get there, but they stayed with their cars.
Yeah.
As you drive by, they're all doing the old hippie thing, was this, you know, they're sitting on the roofs of their cars along the motorway.
Wow. Well, Henry, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Amazing to sit and talk to you.
Yeah.